Well, I was like super impressed when I read the titles for this particular series. I'm just doing this one, The Cry of the Refugee. But to see that you're doing a series looking at the cry of the poor, the cry of the oppressed, and so on and so forth, because as I kind of just mentioned before in this interview, I do feel like in our society today, lots of people like you and me, like, you know, middle class Anglo people in nice suburbs, go about their business, get kind of busy at school, at work, commuting, catching trains, driving cars, doing jobs, raising families, all that kind of jazz. And it's very easy to kind of suppress the cry of the poor or the cry of the outsider. It's very easy to go through life and not to actually hear that. You're not confronted by it very often. Maybe you might put the news on, for example, and see some story from a war zone somewhere, but it's easy for you to just like go on to the next story and to forget about that. We're not actually hearing the cry very often at all. And so here's a church that's going to say, okay, well, I know you live in a world like that. I know it's easy for you to actually forget that there's much poverty in this world. It's very easy for you to actually hear the refugee calling out to you. But what we want to do is, like, at least throughout the month of February, we want you to hear the cries of those who are asking us to actually fulfill the very things that God had placed on our hearts as Christians to do in the first place. Occasionally, though, the voice breaks through. Occasionally, though, you just can't ignore the cry of the refugee or the cry of the poor or the cry of the homeless, whatever the case may be. Like when a bunch of homeless people set up a makeshift tent city in Martin Place recently. It's like, well, you couldn't ignore it. Ooh, the cry of the homeless burst forth. With respect to the cry of the refugee, for many of us, it was very difficult for us to ignore their cry. When a few years ago, the Guardian newspaper released the Nauru Papers. Do you remember this, the Nauru Papers? This was the medical reports from the clinic at Nauru had been smuggled out and released to the Guardian newspaper, who just published them holus bolus. This is not, I suppose, the cry of refugees speaking. This was medical reports in medical language describing the kinds of conditions that were being presented to the clinic. And as you read through those, I don't know if you did or not, I don't know if you remember encountering them or not, I remember reading them and just thinking, it was just overwhelming to read the stories of the numbers of women who were sexually assaulted by guards and locals on Nauru. It was just, I mean, you would read these women presenting with the symptoms of having been sexually assaulted, physical assaults, men being beaten, children being beaten. And then, probably the most heartbreaking for me anyway, as I read them, was to hear the impact of ongoing hopelessness and trauma being inflicted upon children by being imprisoned on Nauru. I mean, I guess if you committed a crime, and these people have not, as you might know, to claim asylum, cross borders and claim asylum as refugees is not illegal. So they're not on Nauru because they've committed a crime and they've been sentenced to anything. In fact, many of them have been shown to actually be refugees. Now, if you had, though, committed a crime and you were in a detention centre, you would have a sentence, wouldn't you? You would, like, check it. I don't know, I haven't been in prison, but I've seen all the movies where they cross off the days on the calendar waiting until their 5 years, 10 years, whatever it is, might be up. Imagine that there's no end in sight. I mean, imagine the incredible hopelessness, the helplessness that would start to really tear at a person's soul. And imagine not being able to say to a child, don't worry, honey, by the time you're in year five, we'll be out. Or when you go to high school, you know, we'll be free. You can't even say that to your children. And you would read these stories where children were showing overt signs of depression and trauma. One of them that really stuck in my mind was this small child who was eating stones in the exercise area of the detention center in an attempt to kill herself. Like, it's like, you know, I can't find a knife or a gun or anything sharp that could kill me, so I will just eat. How many stones do I have to eat before that will kill me? I mean, could you imagine the long, slow, suicidal impulse that would lead a child to do something like that? So I'm reading these reports as they're released to the Guardian newspaper, and I just thought, I just can't conceive of how we as Australian citizens could think, oh, sure, do that in my name. Yeah, sure, like, yeah, expend my taxes on maintaining this particular policy. And as I said to you, you know, you and I may differ on what an immigration policy should look like, but how could we differ on the fact that this is unacceptable? Mandatory detention for families, and especially for children who've been born into this country seeking asylum. I'm part of an organisation called Love Makes a Way. We just talked about some of the things that we do, and I remember calling the guys who kind of run their actions and saying, what can we do about this? How do we get this word out? And I've done lots of things where, you know, you've gone and stood out. My local member is Tony Abbott. Yours is Scott Morrison. These are the architects of our current immigration policy. I've stood outside his office. I've had meetings with him. We've done all that kind of routine. But on this particular occasion, a number of us who are ministers, Anglicans, Uniting Church, Catholics, I was the sole Baptist. We met and went to the Prime Minister's electoral office in Darling Point or Rushcutters Bay. Again, we knew he wasn't there. It was his Sydney office. But we went into the office and we engaged in a Love Makes a Way pray-in, as they're called. It's a non-violent direct action. It's a sort of kind of thing that people like Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King and people like that do. It's like you enter into a public space and you refuse to leave in order to direct attention by the media to this particular issue. So we walked in, there's a kind of a waiting area, there's a window here. We walked over to the window, we said, we're all clergy, we're all ministers. It looked pretty obvious because all the other religions have outfits, you know, so us Baptists, no outfit, you know. I wore a black shirt to kind of look sort of religious, but it's like we're here to pray through the Nauru papers. And she's like, oh, you can't stay here. And we're like, well, we're going to. She's like, I'm going to have to call the police. We're like, okay, well, you'll have to do that. So we got into the waiting area and we got on our knees in a circle. And we had the Nauru papers. We're reading them and praying for them. We're praying for each person, this sexual assault victim, this suicide attempt. We're reading them and then calling out to God on their behalf. The police arrive, they walk in. No policeman ever wants to arrest an elderly nun. That's something I've discovered. And we happen to have an elderly nun in our midst. So it's like, so they walk in, they're like, oh yeah, no, we don't have to arrest these people. So they went over to the window and I could hear them while we're praying and they're saying, oh, listen, like, you know, you can still conduct business with these guys. They're just praying. Look, if they're still here at 5 p.m. and you want to close up, call us. And this was like 10 a.m. So that's when I knew I'm going to be praying through the Nauru papers until 5 p.m. I remember actually thinking, can I? Can I pray that long? So we prayed. We prayed, we sang, we worshipped. These are ministers, only one of them I'd actually ever met before. These are brothers and sisters of mine I never met before. I spent a whole day praying through, reading these horrible stories, weeping as we read them, praying for these people. And then at like 4:45, obviously the office staff had phoned and the door bursts open and in come like 15 cops. And at that point, because we'd like, it, you know, have you ever been in a prayer meeting where it's like you said you'll go to a certain time and it's like, you do start to, I mean, I'm pretty godly, but like you do start to run out of prayer, you know what I mean? And so someone had said, I know, look, the cops should be here soon. Why don't we sing Amazing Grace? At various points throughout the day, they'd sung other hymns and I'm the worst hymn rememberer in the world. So a few times I'd just be doing the, you know, that singing where you don't know what you say. But Amazing Grace, I thought, got it, I know that one. So we launched into Amazing Grace, except, I don't know about you, I don't know how Caring Bar Baptist does this, but I'm pretty sure there's like only four verses to Amazing Grace. But if you are Catholic, Uniting Church or Anglican, you know like 25 verses to Amazing Grace. I'm not kidding. So we start into the first verse of Amazing Grace as the door swings open and in walk like all these cops. they all kind of surround us. And it was quite funny because we're singing Amazing Grace, obviously a spiritual song. These cops kind of sort of walk in to get us and we're singing and they're like... they all kind of like stand back a little bit. They all look to their commanding officers. He's like... so they all settle. So we're surrounded at this point by policemen while we're on our knees, we're singing Amazing Grace. And then as we finished the first verse, he would like step forward and then the next verse would start. He'd be like... step back again. On and on and on this went. In the end, I was just making up verses. I'm thinking like, what's with the Uniting Church? How do they know so many verses to Amazing Grace? Every time we finish a verse, they'd all bristle like, we're ready. And then they'd be like, oh, yeah, yeah. Like, and it just felt, I don't want to get super spiritual about this, it just felt like we had this like Amazing Grace force field bubble over us. Like, as long as we kept singing Amazing Grace, even the Australian Federal Police officers could not get in. There was something about them. With all the armory and all the authority of the police, there was a feeling like, oh, we can't interrupt this sacred moment. Finally, though, you do run out of verses to Amazing Grace. We weren't just singing it to keep them at bay, but I did find it a bit comical, I have to admit. Finally, we finished the final verse to Amazing Grace, and the guy in charge steps forward and goes, oh, I'm going to have to stop you there. I was like, you're going to stop me 20 verses ago, actually. He then goes through the routine I mentioned to you before. It's like, you do realise that you're in federal or Commonwealth property. Yes, we are. You've been asked to leave. Yes, we have. You are aware you've been asked to leave. Yes, we have. It's a whole process you go through. And then they say, will you leave? And you say, no, we won't leave. Well, if you won't leave, I'll be forced to arrest you. And it's like, well, we won't leave. And I don't know if you knew this. And don't admit it if you do, because that would indicate to us all that you have been arrested before. But apparently the protocol is that while a policeman has his hands on you, you are arrested. But as soon as he releases you, you're released from that policeman's custody. So he does the routine, well, I'm going to have to arrest you now, and then calls the police in. Each one goes to each minister, and one grabs my arm and lifts me up. You're under arrest. I said, okay. It wasn't terribly intimidating because this policeman looked like he was about 15 years old to me. So I think they gave me the work experience police officer on that occasion. But so he takes my arm, you're under arrest, okay. And then we walk over to the door, and then when we get to the door, to open the door, he lets go and opens the door and walks through. But I'd been told in training, when they let go of you, you just stop, you stay where you are, you're not moving. So he opens the door and then I stop and he's like, oh, come on. Takes my arm and leads me out. And as we were walking out into the foyer and then out to the media, he says, I came here at 10 o'clock, he said. He said, have you been praying that whole time? I said, yeah, we prayed all day for that little girl who was eating those rocks. And for that mother of two who was sexually assaulted by three guards. And for that little boy who's got scars up and down his arm because he cuts himself all the time. We prayed all day for these people. And I remember him looking at me while he's marching me out to the police wagon saying, like, all day. And I said to him, dude, I didn't call him dude, sorry. I said, officer, like, that's how important this is. Don't you agree? Like, what else could we do when we know that this is happening? What else could we do? I mean, there's nothing for us to do except to cry out to God. God, hear the cry of the refugee. God, hear the cry of this little child. God, hear the cries of these ones who have escaped from one trauma to land themselves into another trauma. What else could we do? Those of us filled with the Holy Spirit of God. As he's putting me into the police wagon, he says, I agree with you guys. And I said, well, you get in here too. No. My friends, when we go to look at the scriptures to ask ourselves, what does it say about speaking up for the poor? What does it say about sharing our resources? It's a little bit hard to find out, where does it not say something about that? Like, which parts of the Bible are you going to go to that don't tell me that God is a God of justice, that God is a God who calls his people to practice hospitality, that God calls his people in the old covenant to Israel and the new covenant through Christ? Find me some section where it doesn't say, like, practice hospitality, be generous, open your homes, your hands, your lives to the cries of those who are oppressed or who are broken. So when I was thinking, well, what passage would I actually look at in this respect? It's like it was hard to think, well, which ones wouldn't I? But I feel like the Lord's led me to a particular story. It's in Luke chapter 12. It's a story Jesus tells to a man who is getting this whole thing totally wrong. In Luke chapter 12, in fact, if you haven't read Luke chapter 12 lately, the whole of the chapter is all about, don't worry, you'll be okay, I will feed you, I will protect you. If you get persecuted, I'll be alongside you. If you're in prison and you don't know what to say, I'll give you words to say. The whole chapter is all about, you'll be okay, God is with you. And then in the middle of the chapter, this particular thing happens. In verse 13, it says, someone in the crowd said to Jesus, here's Jesus talking all about, don't worry, you'll be okay. If you're persecuted, if you're imprisoned, I'll give you the words to speak. He's speaking to this whole crowd, and then in the middle of the crowd, someone says to him, Rabbi, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. Now, could you imagine what would lead someone to say that under these circumstances? It's just sort of like, we often read over this particular chapter like, oh, that's interesting. Interesting, wait, that's weird. Like, why would you say that? Why would you say, Rabbi, excuse me, can I interrupt your teaching for a second? Could you tell my brother to divide my inheritance with me? Like, why would you be in a situation like that? Well, we don't get it, but if you were reading this in the first century in Israel, you get it totally. Because there was a convention in Israel at that time. It kind of went like this. If a man died and left his estate, to just make it simple, two sons, those two sons would have to agree on the division of the estate before they could accept the inheritance. Now think about this, folks. When a man in first century in Israel leaves his estate to his sons, there's no superannuation, there's no bank accounts, there's no money. It's not a suburban block of land you could just sell, liquidate the asset and split it 50-50. When you leave your estate to your sons, what are you going to leave to them? You're going to leave Israel to them. You're going to leave earth to them, dirt. And so when you are leaving your estate, think about this. It's not like just a square block, let's just draw a line down the middle. Your particular land might be close to a water source over here or a roadway over there, or part of it might be arable and some of it might be rocky. I mean, it wouldn't be easy just to draw a line through the middle. Actually, in order for you both to get kind of an equal portion of the estate, you'd have to kind of draw a squiggly line through it, wouldn't you? To say, okay, well, we'll share the water source here, and we'll share the roadway there. It'd be a long, protracted negotiation. Okay, well, what if we draw the line here? I'll give you that section, you give me this. You'd go into this big negotiation. But if two sons just could not agree, if one son made an offer, here's where I think the line should, no, I don't agree with that. If it was stuck, you could not, that land would just sit there until the two of you would agree. Unless, here's the loophole, if one of the sons or brothers, one of the brothers could get a rabbi or a priest or an elder, a respected authority, if one of the brothers could say, hey, Rabbi, here's what I'm proposing to give to my brother. Do you think that's fair? And if in public, in front of other people, that rabbi said, that seems perfectly reasonable. It wasn't technically legally binding, but there was so much social pressure placed on the other brother that he would just have to capitulate. So when a man calls out, hey, Rabbi, would you tell my brother to divide my inheritance with me? He's saying, will you side with me in front of all these people? Will you agree that my offer to my brother is a fair one and force him, almost like legally, force him to accept the offer that I'm making. So with that background in mind, listen to what Jesus has to say in response. In verse 14, he says, "Man, who appointed me or a judge? Who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you?" What he's saying is, what business is this of mine between you and your brother? Who made me the judge that should decide whether what you're offering is fair or otherwise? And think about this. I'm not even your local rabbi, Jesus is saying. I'm not going to do life with you. I'm not going to go back to your town with you. I won't even live with the implications of anything should I have actually agreed to side with you over this. I'm not your judge. I'm not your arbiter. I am not going to participate in this. You are forcing me to side with you against your brother? Think about it. As soon as you take your brother to court over inheritance, what kind of relationship do you think you're left with your brother? In other words, what you're wanting to do is to sever your relationship with your brother in order to get half of your father's estate. Who made me this judge, says Jesus. And then he keeps going. In fact, he just keeps on and keeps on going. He then says, "Watch out." And the rest of you listen to this too, says Jesus. "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." Man, are you thinking that the greatest gift that you have in your life right now is half of your father's estate? Think again, he says. And then he says, this poor guy is so sorry he asked this rabbi this question. Then he says, "Oh, wait, before you go, get back here. I want to tell you a story." I don't know if you've noticed this in the Gospels, but when Jesus just tells a story to a crowd, it's usually quite encouraging. But when Jesus tells a story to one person, it's usually going to go badly for that person. So it's like, come back here. I've got a story for you. And then he tells this story. Verse 16. "The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest." Now, again, sometimes it's hard for us to really get behind this passage and understand what Jesus' first listeners would have heard. They are Jews in Israel in the first century. So when you start a story, a certain rich man yielded a bumper crop and had more money than he knew what to do with, Jewish listeners in Israel at that time would be thinking, "Oh, well, he must be the hero of the story." Like, as if he's already rich, that means Yahweh has blessed him greatly. And if now he's like got a bumper crop, God has like sent the rains and made the ground fertile. I mean, God has just blessed this guy. I mean, God has just heaped blessing after blessing on this guy. So when you hear a story that begins like this, a certain rich man had a bumper crop, he's now super rich, all of you would be thinking, "Okay, well, tell me more. What can I learn from him? Like, he's the hero of the story." And in the next verse, it totally spins around. In the next verse, Jesus says, "He thought to himself, 'What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops.' Then he said, 'This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry.'" Now again, what would a first century Jewish audience hear when they hear this? A certain rich man has a bumper crop. Wow, he's the hero. Tell me more. And then as soon as the story goes like this, "Then he said to himself, 'I know what I will do. I will do this. I will do that. I will, I. They would immediately be thinking, "What?" Everyone listening to Jesus would know this. If you just had a bumper crop and you now had more money than you knew what to do with, there are a bunch of things you had to do straight away. And the first one was this. You had to go down to the gate of the town or the village where all the old men with white whiskers would all be sitting around. And you would say to them, "Fathers of mine, uncles, grandfathers of mine, a great fortune has befallen me. I have more money than I know what to do with. I don't think I'm ever going to have to work ever again in my life. What should I do with this wealth?" And everyone in that audience would know that all those old men with white whiskers would all be sitting around. They go, ooh, well, we have to think about this all day. Like, we can't just have come up with a snappy answer. I've known missionaries who've actually sat in elders' collectives at city gates, and they all muse and they discuss, and no one throws the solution in too quick, or else you spoil the fun. So you just like add little bits of the story to get more, keep the conversation going. And every single person in Jesus' audience would know that the elders would probably come up with something like this. They would say, "Now wait, God would not just bless you and not want that to be a blessing to your family. So you should give some of your blessing to your brothers, your unmarried sisters, your widowed mother, whoever might be in your family. You should share this with those who are of your blood." Oh, okay, he says, sure. Share with the family, yeah, sure. Anything else? Oh, well, they'd say, well, there's no way God would bless you, already a rich man, without wanting part of that blessing to go to the poor. You should give alms to those who beg, the lame, the sick, the lepers. Okay, give some to the poor, sure. And to the rabbi, they'd say, give some to the rabbi to support the work of God. To the rabbi, definitely, yeah. And then they'd say, give some to the family, give some to the poor, give some to the rabbi. Well, really, why would God bless you and not want that to be something the whole community could celebrate? So we reckon that you ought to slaughter a bunch of fattened calves, should put on some great wine and some good food, and the whole family should have a great big celebration. Oh, big celebration for sure. And then they might have said, with whatever's left over, maybe you should tear down your barns and build bigger ones. You see, what makes this man so pathetic is not just that he wants to store his wealth up for himself, it's that it didn't even cross his mind that he should ask anybody, that he should invite anyone into this process whatsoever. His great sin is to think that he is the master of his own destiny, that he is in charge of the blessings that God gives to him. So the people who were hearing this story and were thinking, oh, he's the guy I should follow, in the rest of the story, they're thinking, he is not the guy I should follow. He's all alone in the world. He doesn't talk to his elders. He doesn't give any to the poor. He doesn't hold a party. He just thinks to himself that he should hoard it all to himself. And having told this story, Jesus wraps it up this way, as if the meaning to the story isn't already clear. He then says, "But God said to this man, 'You fool.'" I imagine that the whole crowd would be like, "Yeah, give it to him, God. You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself?" It's like God steps into the story and says, "I only have to take one thing off you, man. Not your farm, not your house, not your grain, not your... I just have to take your life from you. And then what will come of all of this that you've hoarded to yourself?" And then Jesus wraps it all up and says, This is how it will be for whoever stores up things for themselves but is not rich towards God. Now, this is a really intriguing way Jesus talks about loving him. He's saying, if you think that you are in charge of your possessions, of your wealth, of the blessings that have been poured out to you, if you think you get to decide what your future will be like, if you think it's all just you think, I know what I'll do, I know what career I'll have, I know how I'll spend my money, I know what house I'll have, I know what car I'll have. If it's all just you making all those choices, what he's saying is this: you are not rich toward God. He's saying to be rich toward God would actually be to submit yourself to the voices of the elders in your midst. To be rich toward God would be to share with the poor, To be rich toward God would be actually to celebrate with those of your community and your family. To be rich toward God is to be knitted into a community of hospitality and grace and kindness and mercy. That's what it is to be rich toward the things of God. And then people might say, I don't know if this is your thinking this, but somebody might say, whoa, wait. I thought the gospel, I thought being rich toward God was repenting as an individual and giving your life to Jesus. And it's true that throughout the Gospels, Jesus does talk about individual choices. He talks about how the gospel is like one lost sheep being rescued by a shepherd who leaves the 99 already safe. He talks about a woman turning a house upside down to find one lost coin. He talks about a father who walks down to the roadway every day and scans the horizon searching for his one lost son. So the gospel is about ones. It is about you making an individual choice to repent of your sin and to give your life to Jesus. But it's also about saying, having made this choice as an individual to repent of my sin, to accept Christ as my Savior, to choose to follow the King of the world, to be rich toward the things of God is to submit myself to the elders of our community, to see myself as one who is responsible for the outcast, the outsider, the broken, the refugee, the poor. You fool, says Jesus, that you think you are in charge of the blessings that I have given you. You fool that you think you get to decide what your life should be like. Any blessing I have poured out upon you was given you that you might consider how, God, might I use all that you've given me to bless and to be generous to those who are in greater need than me. You're not saved by doing this. You do this because you were saved. Do you follow? In closing, let me tell you another story. It's a parable too, I suppose. It's a Jewish legend also. It's not scripture. It's not a Jesus parable, but it's a story that mirrors this parable. It's a very powerful story about two brothers. One was a very, very wealthy brother. He had much wealth. He is just fantastic at business, and he'd really made a lot of money. But he and his wife were childless. They were unable to conceive, and they were simply preparing for a life alone, just the two of them, with no children to care for them into their old age. His brother was very poor, not so great at business, you know, okay, just didn't do great at making money. Plus, he and his wife had many children, sons who would care for him and his estate as he grew older, daughters who would care for him physically into his old age. Blessed with many children, but no money. Their father, a wealthy man himself, as he grew older and more frail, was very anxious that should he die, these two brothers would fight over the estate. And he did not want this. He wanted it to be already fair and equitable from the word go. And so, even though his health was failing, he walked out into his fields and he paced them. And he assessed where arable land was and where the water course went and what flooded and what didn't. And he made a very clear assessment of all of his land and then decided where the most equitable place would be to place the middle of the property, all the east to one brother and all the west to the other. And there, even in his failing health, he hammered a marker into the soil, knowing that after he died, they would see this and they would know how the land was to be divided. And sure enough, sometime later, he grew ill. He lay upon his bed. He told his two sons, they sat at one elbow each, and he said, "Sons of mine, I don't want you to fight or to fall out or to take each other to court over my estate. And so I have hammered a marker, a white post into the middle of the estate so that you might know all to the east is yours and all to the west is yours." And shortly after that, he drew his last breath and died. His two sons wept and they grieved. And according to tradition, they buried him as quickly as they could, invited the community to grieve with them. And after all was said and done, and after their father's affairs had been settled, these two sons lay in their bed one night in their separate homes, and they thought like this. The rich son thought to himself, what my father did was not fair. I mean, I have more wealth than I know what to do with. I'm well cared for into my old age, whereas my brother, he can barely make ends meet with all of his children. I know what I'll do. Before dawn, in the darkness, in secret, I will move the waymarker so that he receives a greater share of my father's estate. The poor son lay in his bed that night, tossing and turning and thinking, what my father did was not fair. I have all these children to care for me into my old age. My brother has no one. I know what I'll do. Before dawn, in the darkness and in secret, I will move the marker so that he receives the lion's share to compensate him for the loss of not having children. As the story goes, it was said that two brothers, as the first glimmers of dawn burst over the horizon, met each other at that marker, and they fell into each other's arms, and they wept. And the legend has it that the place where their teardrops fell was the place upon which the city of Jerusalem was built. Friends, that story might have particular resonance for Israeli and Palestinian people, but it has resonance for us too, does it not? Surely we, the redeemed ones, be the ones who would say, let's move the marker so that those who have so little might be compensated. What would it look like for us to defer to each other so much that we fell into each other's arms? My friends, this is not the place where the tears fall and the city of Jerusalem is built. This is where the tears fall and the city of God is built. The city on a hill is built. You're going to call your service the city on a hill? I know you're not on a hill, so I presume that the basis of this is that we might be the city, the society, the community that God intended us to be from the first place. Well, what does that look like? We just sing and listen to sermons on a Sunday and have a youth group? And no, what does it mean for us to be this alternate society, this city on the hill, this new society? It's to be that we are the place where the poor and the homeless and the outcast and the refugee find nurture and support and generosity and love and nurture. We are the ones who will speak for them, will we not? We are the ones who will chain ourselves to fences for them. We are the ones who will write to politicians for them. We are the ones who will take them into our homes. We are the ones who will give our money away to them. We are the ones who will support those who have nothing. We are the ones who will be always moving the marker, always wanting to give more and more and more, because we know all that we have is only that which God has given us anyway, that we are the ones, as tears course down our cheeks, who will fall into the arms of those who have nothing and say, I give this to you because I've become rich to the things of God. Do you follow?